COVID-19 is spreading in Latin America, and just like here in the U.S., the region is underprepared for the pandemic.
The reality is these are societies with enormous levels of poverty, income inequality, and informal workers. It's also a place where the public health system, though universally accessible, is really inadequate even in the best of times.
I'm Duarte Duraldino, and this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 25th. Also, what the pandemic means for the presidential primaries and the Biden and Sanders campaigns.
Since everybody is at home, they may be fairly successful in reaching a lot of voters, and they may find that voters have more time to pay attention to them.
Then, how you and your neighbors could soon be using video games to socialize as orders to self-isolate due to the coronavirus increase.
Surprise, it's not a real party, it's just Animal Crossing.
Let's get going.
I'm talking with you from my home in Manhattan because I'm practicing social distancing. The Takeaway is going to stay here for you, broadcasting live, even though much of our production team is working from home now. And you should keep taking steps to protect yourself and your family in this difficult time. COVID-19 cases in the U.S. keep rising, and the epicenter of the American outbreak is right outside my door here in New York City. Millions of us in the U.S. are living under shelter-in-place orders by now. And on Wednesday, the Senate agreed to a bipartisan $2 trillion package with help for people who lose their jobs and for numerous corporations that are now in financial trouble. But today, we go south to Latin America. The reported number of COVID-19 cases there is so far low, but not all governments are taking the drastic precautions needed to contain the virus. Some Latin American leaders don't seem to be taking the risks very seriously. On March 14th, for example, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, posted a video of himself hugging and kissing supporters. Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, called the coronavirus, quote, a little flu. But throughout Latin America, the coronavirus could have a devastating impact. Many countries there are struggling economically and their healthcare systems are strained. All that while unpopular leaders are fighting to gain the trust of their citizens. Benjamin Gadan is deputy director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program. He was also director for South America on the National Security Council under President Obama. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Greetings.
Also with us is Natalie Alcoba. She is a journalist in Argentina covering the coronavirus for Al Jazeera. Welcome to The Takeaway, Natalie.
Hello.
So Benjamin, if we can put COVID-19 into Latin America's broader economic and political context, how are people there feeling about their economy and their government as the virus is hitting the region?
It comes for Latin America at a particularly inconvenient economic moment. I mean, this is not good for any economy on earth, but Latin America had already been experiencing an extraordinarily slow economic moment before COVID-19. It was a moment of budget cuts, of high debt, and a region that was hardly expected to grow this year, perhaps 1.2%. Now it's going to see a contraction region-wide of around the same amount, with negative growth in all the big economies, including Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico.
If we could focus on Brazil and Mexico for a second, how are the region's biggest economies actually responding to this crisis?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why the economic vulnerabilities are so significant at this point is there's very little fiscal ammunition to direct at stimulus measures. So you have a region that, for example, in 2008, at the last global economic slowdown, was really riding high and had space in its budgets, thanks to high commodity prices worldwide, to be able to respond and stimulate economic activity. Right now, the countries, as I said, have very high debt, very tight budgets. We're in a process of austerity in many places before COVID-19. And so they really don't have anything in the cupboard to turn to in order to rescue economies that are really on edge right now.
I can imagine it's being used as a political tool. Did Brazil's president go so far as to call the virus essentially a trick being used by his political foes in the media? Do I understand that correctly?
Bizarrely, the leaders of Mexico and Brazil, the two most important economies in the region, have been very slow to take the COVID-19 virus seriously. And people are reacting. In Brazil right now, those who are in quarantine head out into their balconies nightly to criticize Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil. The Mexican president has continued to embrace types of economic activity that really run counter to public health guidance at this moment. That'll have economic consequences, but also severe public health consequences in those very important countries in the region.
Natalie, is Argentina acting any differently?
Yeah, I think in sharp contrast to Brazil and Mexico, Argentina has been moving quite quickly in the last little while. I mean, the picture has changed fairly dramatically from a government standpoint over the span of a week. It went from warning people who were over the age of 65 not to go outside, imposing mandatory quarantine for people who had traveled, shutting borders, shutting schools, to a few days ago taking the extraordinary step of ordering a mandatory quarantine for the country. I mean, you can go outside if you want to buy groceries, if you need to go to the pharmacy for essentials. Of course, essential services, people who work in healthcare, the police, the military, they're still able to work. But other than that, we're all indoors. And the president has been very, very firm on this, talking about how they are necessary measures to try to gain some, buy some time for Argentina as it tries to bolster its healthcare system to be ready to respond to something that may be worse.
Duarte, if I could, Argentina, it's pretty remarkable its capacity to take these steps, which, you know, strangle economic activity in the economy that's arguably the most vulnerable in the entire region. So, I mean, just hats off to the public health folks in the government in Argentina who've been willing to take steps that, you know, really exacerbate an economic crisis that predated the coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the economy has been struggling severely for a while now here. Unemployment up, poverty up, all of this is going to make that worse, especially the fact that, you know, we're forced to be indoors for several weeks. The president, Alberto Fernandez, has pulled different levers in terms of whether or not it's giving financial support. It's mobilizing the military to build emergency hospitals. They're also making antibacterial gel and equipment for healthcare staff. But without a doubt, it's going to take its toll. And in the economic context, you know, Fernandez has said to creditors that are, you know, part of this also ongoing issue that Argentina has, which is that it's on the verge of a default. It's told creditors that they're just going to have to wait to get paid for several years.
And Natalie, the issue of having cash in Argentina is big right now because we have inflation, we have a lot of economic turmoil. Do people have enough cash to stock up for food to stay quarantined?
I mean, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think the government is recognizing, there's people that don't. I think that's the reality of it. And the government is recognizing that with different measures. I mean, yesterday they announced that they would be issuing a one-time payment, or at least a payment at the start in April, of 10,000 pesos for people who work as independent contractors or who work in the informal economy here in Argentina, which is a huge segment of the workforce. 10,000 pesos, it's about $150 US. I mean, it's meant to try to bridge the gap, because the reality is that we don't know how long the quarantine is going to be in place, although they've said it until March 31st. There's already talk that it's going to be extended. They're palliative measures, right? Like, they're trying to give people a little bit of a financial lifeline in the meantime.
And you mentioned the quarantine, Natalie. How is the government actually enforcing that quarantine?
Right. I mean, it's taking it quite seriously. So it is a mandatory quarantine, and it is a mandatory quarantine that, if violated, comes with potential prison term. So you can be charged with a crime, which is ignoring rules that would propagate an epidemic. And that comes with anywhere from 6 months to 2 years in jail. And enforcement is intense on the street. There's road checks, police, law enforcement across the country are stopping people who are on the street at this time and asking them why. And if they're people that are able to be on the street, that's one thing. But if they're not, then they're detaining them and essentially they're placing them under house arrest. And although, I mean, without a doubt, the vast majority of people in Argentina are complying with the quarantine, there are lots of people who are not. I mean, in the first 24 hours, the numbers from the government was that there were over 3,000 people who had been detained for violating the quarantine.
Benjamin, as a whole, you hear what is happening in Argentina, and I have issues about how you detain people given a situation with infectious disease and whether they were too close together. But that question aside, how is Latin America's healthcare system equipped to handle a crisis like the coronavirus?
In many parts of Latin America, the health systems were already overwhelmed by the general needs of the public before the coronavirus has imposed demands upon medical professionals and upon the facilities themselves. In Latin America, you had about 2 hospital beds for every 1,000 Latin Americans, compared to 6 that you'd find in Europe, which, as you've seen in places like Italy, also doesn't have the capacity. You also have limitations on the ability to acquire ventilators, respirators, masks. Countries that can produce them are not exporting them, and Latin America doesn't have the manufacturing wherewithal to be able to supply itself with those critical assets. So it's a very difficult situation. It's more acute in the poorest countries in the region or those already in crisis. I think about Haiti, for example, northern Central America. Venezuela will probably be least equipped. It's in the middle of an economic and political meltdown that has lasted for years and sent 5 million Venezuelan refugees outside the country. That creates two problems. At home in Venezuela, the hospitals barely have enough sanitizer within the hospitals themselves to be able to safely operate. And now think about the health burdens on places like Colombia next door that has had to absorb more than 1.5 million Venezuelan refugees with already a very difficult healthcare profile, and now is going to see this population subject to, you know, risks from coronavirus. So it's a pretty severe situation, Duarte. And again, this is a region that already was not up to the task of meeting the basic healthcare needs of its populations before this pandemic.
Is there something unique about South America that the rest of the world is not getting that makes it in any way more vulnerable or would make its response to the virus unique?
Look, in terms of, you know, risk factors, I think what South America faces has a lot to do with poverty and inequality. This is a region where, you know, different than northern Central America, which Americans hear a lot about because of migration, doesn't suffer from these extraordinary levels of gang violence and of poverty, as you see in Haiti and you see in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. So people may think these are more prosperous societies that, number one, have the wherewithal to provide medical care, and number two, have, again, government resources and large middle-class populations that can weather this pandemic. The reality is these are societies with enormous levels of poverty, income inequality, and informal workers. Latin America in general has nearly half of its workers in the informal sector. It's a region with hugely overcrowded prisons that can be a vector for the spread of this virus. And again, it's a region where people who are working informally and living in these slums are at extraordinary risk. It's also a place, as I mentioned earlier, where the public health system, though universally accessible, is really inadequate even in the best of times. So I think, you know, what people should know about South America is that, contrary maybe to the image of Buenos Aires and Rio as places that attract American tourists and are relatively prosperous for the developing world, in fact, have extraordinary levels of inequality and poverty that elevate the risk of a rapid spread of this virus.
Natalie?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo a lot of what Benjamin said. I think in the case of Argentina, it's been notable to see how quickly the government has been trying to get ahead of what's coming. I think there's an acknowledgement that it's at a disadvantage infrastructurally, without question, economically, in terms of inequality, all of those things. And so as a result, I think you've really seen some decisive action from the government to throw whatever it can at the problem and to just try to be as best prepared as it can, knowing that it's facing a difficult situation.
Thank you so much. Benjamin Gadan is the Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Latin American Program, and L.A. Alcoba has been covering the coronavirus outbreak for Al Jazeera from Argentina. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues, so does the campaign for the President of the United States. But it looks pretty different than it did a few weeks ago or even a month ago. Senator Bernie Sanders and Vice President Joe Biden have not held campaign events with an in-person audience since early March. President Trump also rescheduled campaign events. And now, because public health officials are pushing social distancing to help contain the virus, at least 13 states are postponing their primaries. But nearly half the country's states still need to vote. Elaine Kmark is here with me to check in on the primary process and to explain how the virus could affect you during this electoral season. She's the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Elaine, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me.
So a lot of states already postponed their primaries. Is there any historical precedent for this?
No, the only historical precedent that comes to mind was that the New York primary was scheduled 2 days after 9/11 in New York. So they did postpone that until the 25th of September, from early in September, because obviously it was an extraordinary circumstance. And then in New Jersey, after the huge Sandy storm, if you'll remember, they didn't extend the primary, but they did lessen some of the rules on displaced voters, because there were a lot of people who couldn't actually get to polling places or were too busy trying to take water out of their houses and things like that. So those are the only two in recent memory.
So how will these postponements affect the state elections in the long run?
Well, I don't think they should. I mean, most of these have postponed until June, okay? I mean, I think the earliest postponement is Georgia, that postponed till May 19th. And what I think this is going to do is the postponement will give the states time to ramp up their absentee ballot procedures, and if they're a vote by mail state, to make sure they've got the capacity for vote by mail. So I think, you know, let's hope that maybe by June we see a little bit of relief from this. But even if not, I think this will give plenty of time for states to get ready to do essentially voting by mail.
You know, Elaine, the editorial board of the New York Times is calling for mail-in ballots to be a clear and free option for every voter this year. Is this a realistic alternative to in-person voting on the national level?
Well, eventually, yes. And it is literally a question of how quickly can the states ramp up. Now, you know, it's interesting. Two-thirds of the states already have either absentee balloting with no excuse required, okay? And then a couple of states already have full mail-in voting. So it's changing the statutes on this isn't hard. Two-thirds of the states have already made some progress in this direction. What gets harder is that they'd have to print lots more ballots than they are accustomed to printing. And then the counting of the ballots is difficult because, you know, when you have a normal election, you have machines that you're tabulating the ballot. So that's why we're accustomed to knowing the results of an election on election night. Well, with mail-in ballots, it sort of depends on when you start counting those ballots. And a lot of state laws say you can't start counting until election day itself. So what states will have to do then is ramp up their procedures for counting just lots more ballots than they are accustomed to counting. And it may take, we may have to be a little bit patient and wait 24 or 48 hours before we hear election results, as opposed to, you know, getting them 2 hours after the polls close.
Last week, Arizona, Florida, and Illinois held primaries as scheduled, but Ohio, well, that state decided to postpone. For
right.
those states that decided to push forward, were there any drawbacks?
It's interesting. It's a little bit of a mixed bag. So in Arizona and Florida, turnout actually increased from the turnout in the Democratic primary 4 years ago. Okay. And Florida, of course, had a record number of mail-in ballots. So in those two states, it increased. In Illinois, it decreased. So there's obviously going to be some looking at Illinois and its procedures for absentee ballots or mail-in ballots.
So how is this, these postponements affecting presidential candidates' campaigns? What are the candidates doing now when they can't really hold in-person campaign events?
They're doing electronic town halls. I mean, they're doing, you know, kind of what you in the broadcast business do all the time, right? They're trying to sit in their homes, you know, and talk to America and talk to the voters in upcoming states. I just read this morning that Joe Biden has had a TV studio installed in the rec room of his house. And so I suspect that they're doing things like that. They're going to increase clearly their presence on the internet and through social media. And they're going to try to keep talking to voters just in a very different way. Now, what's interesting about that is that wouldn't necessarily be as effective if we were in a normal situation. But since everybody is at home, they may be fairly successful in reaching a lot of voters, and they may find that voters have more time to pay attention to them.
If the virus is still present in the fall, what do you think election officials are going to do? How might that change the way we vote outside of these ballots?
I think that they'll do two things. I mean, obviously, they'll try to increase the number of mail ballots. But then I think they'll probably institute the sorts of things that we're seeing in some of the big box stores like Costco, staggering the number of people who can go in at any one time, making sure that they're 6 feet apart, having the machines or whatever people touch wiped down after each vote, providing protective gear for the poll watchers, maybe recruiting some younger poll watchers. You know, the poll watchers traditionally are fairly old because retired people have tended to do it. We may want to recruit some 25-year-olds to be poll watchers as opposed to 65-year-olds.
Elaine Kmart is the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
On.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Duarte Geraldino. As you know at this point, being cut off from your family and friends because of the coronavirus is hard. So some people are turning to the online world for social connections. A new video game from Nintendo called Animal Crossing New Horizons is one online space providing a lot of people with a social lifeline. In the game, each player builds an island town where animal villagers live, sort of like The Sims video game, but with cute animal neighbors. But it also gives you the ability to virtually hang out with your friends. Now, socializing is one of the key components of this game. You're encouraged to talk to your villagers and visit a friend's town online, where you can talk and trade digital items with them. And this is important, because while social gatherings may no longer be happening in real life, they are in Animal Crossing, even weddings. For example, Nas Ahmed and Sharman Asha had already postponed their wedding twice. Their third date was all set for April 12th, then the coronavirus hit and they had to cancel again. Amidst all the stress, Nas and Sharman each bought a copy of Animal Crossing to pass the time while stuck inside. That's when Nas got an idea.
When I started playing, I saw the beach location, and I was like, wow, this looks pretty scenic. And I remember we were talking about, you know, potentially doing a beach wedding at some point. So in the back of my mind, I'm like, wait, maybe I could, like, do, like, an impromptu wedding online with our friends just to, like, mess around a little bit.
So Nas secretly began gathering a group of friends to meet up in Animal Crossing, and when the time was ready, he invited Sharman to his island. When Sharman walked on the island, she followed arrows Nas had left for her, guiding her toward the beach. And that's where she found five of her friends and Nas standing by a bonfire. They were at the end of a white carpeted aisle covered in hearts and flowers.
Surprise, it's not a real party, it's just Animal Crossing.
Sharman is about to graduate med school, but because of the coronavirus, her graduation, like her wedding, is also canceled. And not being able to celebrate these milestones with her family and friends took a toll on her, making her Animal Crossing wedding all the more meaningful.
I got emotional as I would be for a while.
You had to step out, right?
I had to, like, step back and, like, go to the bathroom because, I don't know. It just felt embarrassing to be getting, like, emotional over Animal Crossing wedding. It, like, meant a lot to me that my friends who are amazing could come together and have this much support through a medium that's virtual, not really there, but just has, like, so much heart in it.
Sherman now says she's going to get an Animal Crossing tattoo to mark her graduation and commemorate her Animal Crossing wedding. Nas and Sherman are just one of the many examples of people spending time together and creating memories in online games during this pandemic. Now, Rachel Coward is a psychologist and research director at Take This, which is a mental health nonprofit that works with the gaming community and industry. She says video games can help ease the pain of isolation. And that pain is real. A lack of social interaction can impact your mental health.
When we socialize, we are directly contributing to outcomes like longevity, an increased immune system, greater cognitive functioning, reduced risk for dementia, reduced sense of loneliness. I could go on all day. So not having that sense of socialization is the opposite, right? Increased sense of loneliness, increased sense of depression, a depressed mood.
So if you don't play video games, can you tell me some ways that online gaming can make you feel connected to others and reduce those feelings of isolation?
Absolutely. So games are a wonderful way to socially connect all the time, but especially now that we are becoming, you know, more physically distanced. They are easily accessible. They are shared with other people, both people that you know and people that you don't know, and they're fun. So research has found that playing together online can reduce sense of loneliness and have all of those same benefits that we see in traditional research looking at socialization.
One of the things that I always notice when I go out with my friends is that, you know, we shake hands, we hug, there's always a pat on the back, and there's these subtle moments where we let people know we're here, not necessarily talking to someone, but touching them. Obviously, that's not available in these digital interactions. So does the brain perceive these online interactions differently than they do in the real world?
I mean, that's a good point about the sense of touch. That is true that you cannot get that in a mediated space, but humans are very crafty and we've come up with a lot of kind of social accommodations that we do online to kind of mitigate the differences. So for instance, there's been research looking at players standing closer to one another or using gestures or emojis to kind of indicate this sense of social closeness. And while it's not the same as physical touch, it does mitigate a lot of these differences, which means that the friendships we form online, while different, are often perceived to be as real or more real than any real world relationship.
But what about real people in terms of interactions with computer-controlled character versus a character that's controlled by a player?
I love that you brought this up. This is what we call parasocial relationships, the relationships that you have with, for instance, the characters in the game that are created by the computer. So this term was first developed in the 1950s to describe the relationships we have with TV personalities. The feelings and the emotions associated with it are very real. So there was a study published a few years ago by Emery Daniel and David Westerman, and they analyzed tweets following the death of Jon Snow in Game of Thrones. And they found that the emotions, the sentiments being expressed, were very similar to the emotions that people express when they lose a close friend or another loved one. So on some level, we know these parasocial relationships are not real. Jimmy Fallon doesn't know who I am. Jon Snow is a fictional character, but the emotions we feel are the same. So if we look at a game, for instance, Animal Crossing is a brand new game that just came out. There are fellow villagers with you in this space. You go to a deserted island and you make a house and you have neighbors. I know that the neighborhood squirrel is not my friend, but when I speak with him, the sense of connectedness, camaraderie, empathy, compassion, whatever it might be, is very much real.
There's so many different ways to connect with people online now. Is there something different about the connection that we make through video games as opposed to social media or message boards like Reddit?
For sure. So games have the added element of playfulness, and this makes them very distinct, say like what you said, from social media or online message boards. You know, as humans, from the beginning of time, we have been seeking playful activities. You find ruined cities and there are decks of cards and dice among the ruins. Play is not something that we should only think of being critical for childhood, which we often do, but has a range of benefits for people throughout their lifespan. So engaging in these playful activities first in and of itself reduces stress and reduces depression. But in terms of the friendships that are formed, they're what you call in the research emotionally jump-started. So if you're playing online games with someone you don't know in real life, you learn if you can trust them from the very beginning. Can they help me build my village? Can they help me kill this dragon or not? And if I learn I can trust them, and then over time I get to know them, which is kind of the opposite of how our friendships occur at work or at school, where you get to know someone very slowly and then over time learn if you can trust them. So in games, this jumpstart leads to the development of close, intimate, and long-lasting friendship bonds.
Can you suggest any good social games to play? I know you mentioned Animal Crossing. Anything else?
Stardew Valley is wonderful. It's a farming simulator. It's great. Minecraft is also another classic, or even things like League of Legends or Fortnite. All of these games are great because they have closed rooms, which means you can curate who you're playing specifically with if you only want to play with your friends from work or family members, or you can also, you know, open the floodgates and engage with the whole of the internet.
Rachel Kohler is a psychologist and research director at Take This, which is a mental health nonprofit that works with the gaming community and industry. Rachel, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. If you missed anything or want to listen again, check out our podcast. You can also find all of our coverage at thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at thetakeaway. And you can find me on Twitter at Duarte Giraldino. This is The Takeaway. Please stay safe out there. Thanks so much for listening.